Settlement to Superpower, Episode 10, Spanish Scramble. Hello everybody and welcome back. I'm Abraham Ash, and this is From Settlement to Superpower. So, we left off last episode in 1514, with Ponce de León's receival of the governorate of his newly discovered lands, the islands of Florida and Bimini. This episode is going to cover the 13 years from 1514 through 1527. During this time, the conquistadors on the Caribbean islands all sought to follow Ponce de León's lead and discover new lands, which they hoped would then persuade the king to grant them the rights to actually govern those newly found territories. This period, then, was one of rivalry and competition between the various Spanish officials in the Caribbean. They each wanted a slice of land to rule for themselves, and as such they were virtually falling over one another in their haste to discover and colonize new lands. This intense decade and a half of competition between the Spanish officials led fairly frequently to low-level violence and intimidation, as each prospective adelantado staked out his territory and defended it against the inevitable encroachments of the others. This free-for-all was only exacerbated by the fact that the various royal grants given to these explorers and colonizers rarely included well-defined boundaries. Thus, very often you'd find two different people with claims on the same landmass or overlapping areas of jurisdiction. So, this episode we're going to wade through the story of the various contenders for the rights to colonize the southeastern United States. The main characters we're going to discuss are Ponce de León, Diego Velázquez, Francisco de Garay, and Lucas Vázquez de Ayllón. Now, these are all fellows we've met before, and as we're going to be dealing with them more thoroughly now, we're going to go over a few points and incidents we've discussed previously. For example, we're going to talk a little bit more about Velázquez's expeditions under Cordova and Grijalva, which we mentioned back in Episode 4, Children of Aztlán. We're also going to discuss the two expeditions Francisco de Garay sent out under Alonso Álvarez de Pineda, which we've briefly mentioned in episodes 5 and 8 respectively. So we start, quite obviously, with Ponce de León. He had received, as we've just said, the exclusive rights to colonize and govern what they then thought was the island of Florida. However, his grant from King Ferdinand stipulated that first, before he was to colonize Florida and Bimini, he should put down the Caribs of Guadalupe, who were harassing the Spanish on Puerto Rico. Ponce de León set sail from Spain in 1515 and headed straight for Guadalupe. His campaign, however, foundered, and after a year or so of trying in vain to subdue the fierce Caribs, he essentially abandoned the campaign to his inferiors. The immediate cause for this abandonment was the death of King Ferdinand in 1516. Ferdinand's death prompted Ponce de León to return to Spain at once to ensure the renewal of his rights and titles. In this regard, he was successful, but it was to be another 2 years before he would return to Puerto Rico. During this time, he also married for his second time, his first wife having died sometime while he was in Puerto Rico. In any event, for some 2 years following his return to Puerto Rico, Ponce de León did not undertake any new attempt to colonize Florida. Perhaps this was on account of his relatively recent marriage. Or perhaps, as the more sensational historians like to say, perhaps Ponce de León was languishing in depression over his disastrous campaign against the Caribs. Whatever the reason, Ponce de León did not press his claims on Florida during this period of time. And that inactivity of his opened up a window for new interlopers to try and gain a foothold, either through trade or exploration, in his territory. So we're now going to chronicle the various intruders on and threats to Ponce de León's claims in Florida. Just to give you a sense of what the remainder of this episode is going to cover, because it's going to be rather sprawling, we're going to go through the rather insignificant trade voyage of Diego Miruelo in 1517, Diego Velázquez's two expeditions to the coasts of Yucatan and Mexico, and the voyages of Francisco de Garay which followed. We're going to discuss Garay's claim on all the lands north of Velázquez and west of Ponce de León, which obviously poses a threat to Ponce de Leon's western flank. Now, with regards to Garay and his claims on the mainland, we're going to dispense with chronological sequence, by which I mean that we're going to tell Garay's whole story up until 1523 before we go back to 1521 to discuss Ponce de Leon's final attempt to colonize Florida. We're also going to discuss our old friend, Lucas Vazquez de Ayllon, the judge from Hispaniola who had quarreled with Narvaez down in Mexico, and his attempts to plant a Spanish colony in what is now South Carolina, and the dismal failure of that attempt. So, in terms of coverage of Spanish activity in the New World, this episode will cover from 1514 through 1527. Okay. So the first interloper on Ponce de Leon's turf was one Diego Miruelo, who illegally sailed for Florida where he made contact and traded with the natives. Incompetent seaman that he was, however, Miruelo failed to record any latitudes or navigational notes on his journey, and as such we can't even reconstruct where he went. Despite Miruelo's clear amateurishness, however, his trip was still a challenge, albeit a rather inconsequential one, to Ponce de Leon's exclusive rights on Florida and all trade emanating therefrom. The next intrusion as well, while unwelcome, was not a major threat to Ponce de Leon's monopoly on Florida. As a matter of fact, the intrusion was entirely inadvertent. What I'm talking about, of course, is the first voyage dispatched by Diego Velazquez to Yucatan, led by Hernandez de Cordova in 1517. As we've mentioned previously, Velazquez wanted a piece of the pie of all these newly discovered lands, and so he pooled together the resources of several wealthy men, Hernandez de Cordova included, to fund this voyage of discovery. The pilot of this voyage was Anton de Alaminos, the same pilot who had sailed with Ponce de Leon on his first voyage and investigated the Gulf Stream. I should add that there are those who sailed on this voyage who later became Cortes loyalists in Mexico, and these adventurers gave different, sometimes contradictory accounts of what had happened. For starters, they said that the voyage of Cordova was not initially conceived of as a voyage of discovery, but rather as a slave trading expedition. The men, however, the sailors, grew disgusted when they heard of the expedition's purpose, and instead they prevailed on the captains to sail on a voyage of exploration. They also said that Velazquez really hadn't pulled his weight with regards to funding the expedition, but had rather opportunistically inserted himself at the 11th hour by way of some unspecified act of fraud. Now, I'm not going with these accounts, however, because seriously, how credible do you think an accusation against Velazquez is when its only basis is the complaint of a former employee in the form of a deposition presided over by Velazquez's arch-rival, Hernán Cortés? That's right, not at all. Political calumny is one of the oldest weapons in the book, and it seems quite clear that that is precisely what's going on here with regards to the voyage of de Cordova. In any event, as we've gone through earlier, the expedition was an unmitigated catastrophe. It started out well enough. The Spanish sailed up and around the coast of Yucatan, encountering only a few moderately hostile Mayan tribes who either attacked or threatened the Spanish. In one incident, which should have given the Spanish pause, they were met by a group of blood-stained Mayan priests who came with a large group of warriors. The priests ordered a fire be lit, telling the Spaniards, "Behold this torch, which we will light and place between our two armies. If you do not make haste and retreat before the torch is burned, you will die. We do not want you as guests." In that case, the Spanish chose the better part of valor and evacuated the area, moving onwards in the hope of finding a better reception elsewhere. Spoiler alert, they wouldn't. It was on the western coast of Yucatan that disaster struck, near the modern town of Champoton. As the Spaniards went ashore to draw fresh water, they encountered a large band of natives wearing war paint who asked them if they came from the direction of the rising sun. The Spaniards answered that yes, they did, which was apparently the wrong answer, as the natives, like the priests with their torch, had apparently heard news of the terrible events which had been perpetrated to their east. Compounding their error, the Spaniards spent the night on the shore, and when they woke up in the morning, they found that they were surrounded on all sides by angry natives, who immediately launched an all-out attack, complete with deafening war shrieks. The Spanish, used to the far more primitive weaponry and warfare of the Caribbean natives, were unprepared for the coordinated attacks and copper blades of the Mayans, and they were soundly defeated. Over 20 of the Spaniards were killed or captured ashore, and a great deal more drowned or were bludgeoned to death during their chaotic scramble to their ships. A total of more than 50 Spaniards were killed in the defeat, and all but one of the expedition, a soldier named Berrio, had been seriously wounded. Cordova himself had received more than 30 different wounds. In any event, considering as this landing party didn't quite succeed in getting the fresh water they needed, the expedition was now short on drinking water. They didn't, however, want to risk going ashore again on these shores of Yucatan. They had found out that the natives were extremely fierce and could actually defeat them. Alaminos, their pilot, remembered the trip he had taken with Ponce de Leon to La Florida 5 years ago, and he determined to sail the battered expedition there. They made their way to Florida and went ashore to draw fresh water, but once again they were set upon by the Calusa Indians. After a great struggle, during which Alaminos himself received an excruciatingly painful arrow wound to the throat, the Spanish succeeded in retiring to their ships with fresh water, with only one man lost. Ironically, that one man who was lost was none other than Berrio, the one soldier who had escaped the disaster at Champotón unscathed. Apparently, Berrio's luck had run out. He was captured alive by the Indians and never heard of again. Such was the extremity of the Spaniards' condition that Bernal Diaz, who was present at the time, records how one Spanish soldier, crazed by thirst, leapt into the rowboat and drank a bottle of water. He drank too fast for his dehydrated body, however, and within 2 days the thirsty soldier swelled up and died. Anyways, from Florida, the battered expedition limped back to Havana, with Hernandez de Cordova dying of his wounds 10 days after his return. Velazquez, while chastised by the disaster, recognized the potential worth of his discovery and immediately sent forth another expedition, this time commanded by his nephew, Juan de Grijalva. We've discussed this episode at greater length in episode 4, and so I see very little need to do so again, but suffice it to say that Grijalva explored Yucatan and the coast of Mexico up to San Juan de Ulua. While he failed to plant a colony in Velazquez's name and to so solidify Velazquez's claim to these newly discovered lands, he did serve as the impetus for Velazquez to dispatch Cortes to Ulua to trade a bit, maybe set up a little settlement, nothing major, but hey, Cortes would at least be able to prop up Velazquez's claim on Mexico and maybe get a little bit of land in return. Right. But Cortes aside, Cordova and Grijalva's expeditions did serve as the impetus for something very relevant to Ponce de Leon and his claim on Florida. You see, these new discoveries of vast coastlines north and northwest of Cuba began to make Spaniards suspect that maybe in fact the two coastlines formed one contiguous landmass. This was a worrying possibility for Ponce de Leon. Up until now, he had thought that he had an island all to himself. Now, however, there was a strong possibility that what he had discovered was not the majority of a large island, but rather merely a tiny sliver of a massive continent. A whole new continent would mean teams of new adventurers, each staking out their own claims and encroaching on those of their neighbors. Even with regards to Velazquez, who was currently petitioning the crown for the rights to Yucatan and Ulua, how was the crown going to set a boundary between them? If the two distinct landmasses which they were claiming were in fact one and the same, then what would determine where the border between their two territories lay? The answer, presumably, was that whoever would explore and chart the coast between Florida and Mexico would be able to lay claim on them. Now, Ponce de Leon wasn't able to arrange any such sort of voyage as he had only just returned from Spain with his new bride. So instead, that void was filled by a man whom we have previously mentioned, Governor Francisco de Garay of Jamaica. Garay was an ambitious Basque who had come along with Columbus on his second voyage in 1493. He was, throughout his entire career, a fervent supporter of the Columbuses for two primary reasons. First of all, he was related to Diego Colón's wife, so that gave him a familial connection to the ruling family. and second of all, he was temperamentally a man after the Columbus's orderly hearts. Francisco de Garay was no reckless conquistador hurling himself into the thick of every fight. He was more of a businessman than a warrior, which, considering his surroundings, undoubtedly speaks to his credit. Although, of course, Las Casas has nothing nice to say about him. I'm sure you're all noticing a trend here. In any event, these Columbus connections meant that he was squarely within the Columbus camp, and by extension, that meant that he was to become a rival of Ponce de Leon and his cronies, who would do everything in their power to subvert Diego Colón's power. In 1499, Christopher Columbus appointed him Auditor of Hispaniola, a job he fulfilled faithfully for several years. On the side, however, Garay would go prospecting for gold in the hope that he would one day strike it rich. His lucky break came in the year 1502 when one of his Indians uncovered a massive 35-pound gold nugget, valued at approximately 60,000 pesos. This find made Garay a rich man. However, he was a rich man whose windfall came not by careful groundwork and gradual economic expansion, but rather by a single stroke of luck. Garay and his partner, a gentleman by the name of Miguel Diaz de O, may have struck it rich, but it seems as though they seriously overextended their capital in the coming years, because by 1508, the pair of them began a long series of transactions with various Genoese merchant bakers back in Spain, the loan sharks of their day. This indicates a need for new capital on the pair's part, and indeed, Garay's career does take a radically new turn, starting in the year 1511, from the confirmation of Colón's powers in the Indies onwards. Garay, who had been formerly content with relatively minor and subordinate positions in the Indies, suddenly becomes a man with an obsession to discover, colonize, and govern new lands. This dramatic shift in Garay's personality is indeed explained best by a pressing need for more money. I will state straight up, though, that I do not know the original source for this particular detail of our episode regarding Garay's debts to the Genoese bankers. In this, I am relying entirely on Robert S. Weddell's Spanish Sea, the Gulf of Mexico in North American Discovery. In any event, beginning in the year 1511, Garay began a decade of trying unsuccessfully to sustain his wealth through conquest and exploration. In that year, Garay led, with the sanction of Diego Colón, an unsuccessful attempt to conquer the fierce natives of Guadeloupe. In 1512, he obtained from Colón the position of Chief Constable of Hispaniola, and in 1514 he journeyed to Spain to obtain a renewal and expansion of his encomienda rights. That at least was the ostensible purpose of the trip. His real intentions were revealed when he appeared at court and successfully petitioned the king for the island of Jamaica, whose conqueror, Juan de Esquivel, had recently died and had not yet been satisfactorily replaced. Garay managed to convince the king to grant him control over the royal estates in Jamaica and to tacitly endorse his plans to explore to the west and north of the islands. Garay returned to Hispaniola a few months later, where Diego Colón happily confirmed the royal appointment and granted Garay the lieutenancy of Jamaica. However, despite Garay's plans to set out exploring immediately, he had even brought provisions for such a voyage while back in Spain, he was unable to actually begin the work of exploration. This was, to a large degree, due to the fact that Jamaica was a bit of a money pit, with poor infrastructure and a virtually non-existent economy. Garay had to spend his first few years in Jamaica working to improve the local economy, building a sugarcane mill, and marshalling the island's remaining native population towards the production of woven goods. It was not until 1517 that he even had a chance to send an expedition, and by then, Velazquez was already sending out his ill-fated expedition under Hernandez de Cordova. Garay waited until he heard the reports from Cordova and Grijalva's expeditions to see whether there was a prosperous region to be uncovered before he finally decided to send his own expedition out to explore all lands not yet found by Velazquez. In other words, the opportunistic Garay allowed Velazquez to do all the legwork and swallow all the financial risk of striking out into unknown waters, and when success seemed all but guaranteed, Garay jumped into the action and took all the credit for himself. Be that as it may, in the spring of 1519, Garay was ready to send out his first expedition, just a month and a half after Cortes' departure for Yucatan in Mexico. Four ships loaded with 270 men set out from Jamaica, well provisioned for a moderately long voyage. Their commander was a man by the name of Alonso Alvarez de Pineda. We know fairly little about this expedition, but I'll put forward what we know happened. Pineda and his men sailed from Jamaica to the southern tip of Florida, where they turned westward, skirting the entire coast between Florida and Cortes' location in Mexico. Along the way, on June 2, 1519, Pineda became the first European to discover the mouth of the Great Mississippi River, destined to become the flashpoint of a rivalry spanning three centuries and four great powers. Pineda reported that all along the coast, the natives he had encountered were friendly, the land prosperous, and the soil fruitful. In early August, Pineda and his men came across Cortes in his newly established city of Villarica de la Veracruz. We mentioned what happened there back in episode 5. In short, Pineda tried to claim the land for Garay, Cortes arrested six men of Pineda's expedition and persuaded them to join his band, and Pineda, an old acquaintance of Cortes, gave up the attempt to outfox Cortes and returned home. Upon Pineda's possible return to Jamaica, and I'm going to soon explain why I use the word possible, Garay immediately sprang into action. He sent a report back to Spain chronicling his success, and he applied for a royal grant to settle his newly discovered land, which he called Amichel. He also sent back a hand-drawn map made by Pineda showing the entire Gulf Coast, the first such map in existence. The royal officials of Charles V, who was in Flanders at the time, readily assented to Garay's request, and in a royal grant issued at Burgos in 1521, Garay was granted full rights to colonize Amichel, whose precise boundaries would be shortly determined by a royal official. Now, of course, and this comes as no surprise, Garay didn't wait around for royal authorization to arrive by the Tortoise Express. He sent Pineda right back to Panuco, at the southwesternmost extremity of Amichel, with instructions to colonize the area and commence trade with the natives. This is at the very least the official account. What a great many historians believe, however, is that it is extremely likely that Pineda never even returned to Jamaica. Rather, he stayed behind with a group of his men to settle Panuco, sending his map and his report ahead to Garay with the others. In any event, shortly thereafter, in early 1520, Garay sent out an expedition under one Diego de Camargo to reinforce Pineda's colony at Panuco. We've mentioned what happened next in episode 8, but I got a bunch of the facts wrong, which I want to set right over here. What I said was the following, and I quote, "Following his failure to convince Cortes of Garay's right to Mexico, Pineda sailed on around the coast of the Mexican Gulf, discovering the mouth of the Mississippi River before returning back to Jamaica. Upon his return, Governor Garay immediately re-outfitted Pineda for another colonization attempt, this time in Panuco, to the north of Veracruz. They had landed and had begun constructing a Spanish fort when they were attacked and defeated by the local Indians. They attempted to re-embark, but soon thereafter, one of their ships sunk, and disease struck down Captain Pineda along with many others of the expedition. The 60 or so survivors limped into Villarica de la Veracruz, ill but well supplied, where they too agreed to join Cortes' expedition in Tapiaca. Two more ships sent by Garay for the relief of Pineda, containing a combined total of some 90 soldiers, 20 horses, and many arms and supplies, also put in at Veracruz. They too happily joined Cortes' force." So, for starters, as you may have already picked up, in my earlier account I had Pineda encounter Cortes at the outset of his voyage, and only after treating with Cortes did Pineda sail on to chart the Gulf Coast and discover the mouth of the Mississippi. As I've detailed at greater length over here, what in fact occurred was that Pineda first explored from Florida westward and only afterwards encountered Cortes on the Mexican coast. Additionally, I previously stated as a given that Pineda returned to Garay in Jamaica and was sent back immediately to colonize the coast of Panuco. Again, as we've seen now, it is far from definite that Pineda actually went back to Jamaica. But that is a relatively minor detail. The most important correction that I need to make, however, is with regards to the circumstances of Pineda's death and the destruction of the colony in Panuco. So I said earlier that the natives attacked the Spaniards upon Pineda's return and defeated them, after which Pineda and his men succeeded in escaping only to die of plague at sea. That's just plain wrong. What in fact occurred was that the natives did in fact attack the Spaniards and inflict upon them a crushing defeat, but Pineda did not manage to escape. Pineda, along with virtually all of his men, was killed, flayed, and eaten by the natives while still ashore. In any event, the remnants of Pineda's crew, as well as the several shipments of reinforcements sent for his colony by Garay, made their way to Cortes for the final siege of Tenochtitlan. Nor did Cortes stop at pirating Garay's men and resources. Cortes knew that Garay had been granted the rights to all of Amichel, which included a great many territories, including Panuco, which Cortes desired all for himself. Cortes therefore actually sent emissaries in 1522 to Charles V seeking to revoke Garay's grant. Although Cortes's emissaries endured many delays and travails on their way to Spain, including a defeat at the hands of Spanish pirates, most of them succeeded in making it to Spain. The king was convinced by them to give Cortes exclusive rights over the newly created territory of New Spain, which included all of Cortes's conquests and Panuco, although Garay's rights to the rest of Amichel were left untouched. Garay, who did not yet know that the king had revoked his right to Panuco, was most unpleased with Cortes's theft of the men in his hire, as well as vexed by the failure of his colony in Panuco and furious at Cortes's attempts to usurp his rightfully held claims. Garay decided, therefore, to lead the next attempt to colonize Amichel on his very own. No more sending others to botch the work for him. Garay was now going to go and botch it all on his own. Garay, in his desire to defeat Cortes, decided to join forces with Diego Velazquez, whose claims he was willing to recognize south of the Panuco River. This pact between the two men Cortes had cheated out of their respective claims was solidified by the inclusion of Juan de Grijalva, Velazquez's nephew and the discoverer of the Mexican coast, in Garay's expedition. On June 24, 1523, Garay and his final expedition departed from Jamaica for Panuco, over 950 strong, with significant numbers of cavalry and cannon. 1 month later, Garay and his men made landfall on what is now the coast of Mexico. They had, however, landed considerably farther north than they initially intended, approximately 90 nautical miles north from the River Panuco. Garay could have safely chosen to establish a settlement there, free from the meddling interference of Cortes down in Mexico. That would have been the smarter thing to do. Instead, Garay allowed himself to be persuaded by his lieutenants, and perhaps by Grijalva as well, to make the long trek down the coast to the original favored site on the Panuco River. The journey down the coast was one of difficulty and privation. One of the men present wrote back to a friend in Spain, "We have come to the land of misery, where there is no order whatsoever but everlasting toil and all the calamities which treat us so cruelly. Hunger, the heat, malignant mosquitoes, foul bedbugs, vicious bats, arrows, vines that encircle, mudholes and swamps that swallow us." The ships accompanying them down the coast encountered difficulties as well. 4 out of the 11 ships had been lost in inclement weather. The most eventful thing which occurred on the landward trek was the discovery of the armadillo, a beast described by the Spanish as a quadruped a little larger than a cat, with the face of a wolf, silver-colored, scaly, and caparisoned as the armed cuirassier going into battle caparisons his horse. A sluggish creature, it folded itself up like a hedgehog or tortoise on seeing a man at a distance, and allowed itself to be caught. The poor armadillo was taken to the ships, where it soon died of neglect and starvation. When Garay and his men, after an arduous slog through marsh and river, finally arrived at and crossed the Panuco, they found that Cortes had already beat them to it and established a settlement there, called Santi Esteban del Puerto. A standoff between the two parties ensued until the low morale of Garay's men led to widespread defection among his force, forcing him to parley with Cortes in Mexico City. As a side note, just to keep track of our characters, Garay met an old friend of his in Mexico City who had fallen on hard times and was rotting in prison, Pánfilo de Narváez. The unfortunate man had been held prisoner by Cortes ever since his defeat at Cempoala in 1520, and now Garay petitioned Cortes to release him. Cortes assented and Narváez returned back home to Cuba in 1524, although, as we'll see next episode, it might have been better for Narváez to stay where he was. In any event, with you guys knowing Cortes, I don't think I really need to tell you how his negotiations with Garay went. Cortes very graciously met with Garay and very soon reached a generous agreement allowing Garay to colonize north of the Panuco. This pact between Cortes and Garay would be sealed with the betrothal of Cortes's young illegitimate daughter to Garay's son. The two men attended midnight mass together on Christmas Eve 1523, the very picture of amicable business associates. Following the mass, the two dined together in Cortes's residence, and later that night, Garay fell violently ill. Within 3 days, he was dead, and his grant to settle Amichel was dead with him. Cortes claimed that Garay died of grief upon hearing of an Indian uprising up at Panuco. A friend of Garay's tells us that he died of pneumonia. Everybody else said that he died of poison, a victim of yet another of Cortes's intrigues. I'll let you be the judge for yourself. And that's the end of Garay and his role in the exploration and settlement of America. We should not think, however, that just because he and his plans came to grief in Mexico that he was not a formidable force in the shaping of regional politics. 3 years before his death, in the beginning of 1521, Garay was still very much a force to be reckoned with. So much so, in fact, that his voyage was one of the driving reasons, if not the driving reason, behind Ponce de León's decision that it was time to get a move on the colonization of Florida. Now, I have yet to see a history that explicitly ties the motive of Ponce de León's second voyage with the discoveries of Garay's lieutenant, Alonso Álvarez de Pineda, as well as Garay's subsequent claim on the entire region between Florida and Mexico. However, such a connection seems to me to be extremely unlikely, in no small part due to the letter which Ponce de León sent to the emperor informing him of his upcoming voyage and motives dated the 10th of February 1521. I'll quote the letter here in full. "Among my services I discovered, at my own cost and charge, the island Florida, and others in its district, which are not mentioned as being small and useless. And now I return to that island, if it please God's will, to settle it, being enabled to carry a number of people with which I shall be able to do so, that the name of Christ may be praised there, and your majesty served with the fruit that land produces. And I also intend to explore the coast of said island further, and see whether it is an island, or whether it connects to the land where Diego Velazquez is, or any other, and I shall endeavor to learn all that I can. I shall set out to pursue my voyage, hence, in 5 or 6 days." End quote. So, there are two things which really stand out when we closely examine this letter of Ponce de León's. The first thing is that the letter is essentially defensive. He's clearly trying to butter up the king. Note how he mentions in the beginning that he discovered Florida at his own cost and charge, and that Florida is not mentioned as being small or useless. Ponce de León is clearly trying to defend himself against some threat to his claim. But what can that threat be? The answer comes to us from the remainder of Ponce de León's letter. Not from what he writes, but rather from what he doesn't. Ponce de Leon states, I also intend to explore the coast of said island further and see whether it is an island and whether it connects with the land where Diego Velazquez is or any other, and I shall endeavor to learn all I can. You notice that? A full year after Pineda explored the entire Gulf Coast on behalf of Francisco de Garay, and still, somehow, Ponce de Leon seems to be completely clueless that his discovery connects to the rest of the coast. There's no other way to interpret this than to say that Ponce de Leon was lying, pretending not to know about the discoveries of his rival so that he could claim them for himself. Perhaps he thought that the king would fall for his artifice. Perhaps he thought that the king would deliberately fall for his artifice in order to give the rights to Amichel to him, a fervent royalist, rather than to Garay, a partisan of the Columbuses. Whatever his calculations, though, his motives show clearly enough through this letter. It is a brazen attempt to cover up Garay's achievements and claim them as his own. Ponce de Leon was trying to lie his way into Amichel. In any event, whatever his motives, Ponce de Leon departed for Florida on February 20th, 1521. Like many of the other voyages of that time, we don't know very many details about the particulars of the expedition, only that Ponce de Leon landed on the western coast of Florida, in the vicinity of where he had landed 8 years earlier. As had occurred back then, and again when Cordova landed there, the natives were quite hostile and they fell upon the Spaniards with overwhelming numbers, as the Spaniards were erecting the buildings for their settlement. Many Spaniards were killed or wounded, including Ponce de Leon himself, who had received a wound to his thigh from a poisoned arrow. His losses were so great and his pain so terrible that Ponce de Leon returned at once to Cuba, where he lingered on in agony for several weeks before succumbing to his wounds sometime during the month of July. Thus Ponce de Leon met the same fate which befell most of his fellow conquistadors, a violent death. Those who lived by the sword, more often than not, died by the sword as well. So the final attempt to colonize what is now the United States for this episode is that of Lucas Vazquez de Ailon, the judge from Santo Domingo. Ailon was a relative newcomer to this game, having been uninvolved in these sorts of colonial capers until 1521. In 1521, following his ignominious deportation from Mexico, Ailon suddenly developed an interest in exploration and colonization. It's quite likely, of course, that this sort of idea popped into his head as a result of what he had seen and heard of the wealth of Cortes' Tenochtitlan. But speculation aside, for some reason or another, Ailon became interested in exploring and colonizing his own piece of land. To do so, however, he couldn't look at the Gulf Coast. Every inch of that was already claimed. You had Velazquez and Cortes squabbling over who owned the rights to Mexico. You had Ponce de Leon who claimed Florida, while Garay claimed all the land in between. So instead, Ailon chose to explore north, up the eastern seaboard. He sent a man by the name of Francisco Gordillo, whom he tasked with the job of exploring as far north as he was able to, with the strictest of instructions to maintain friendly relations with any Indians he may encounter. Gordillo sailed northwards, shortly thereafter joining up with another ship sent by Juan Ortiz de Matienzo, a different judge in Santo Domingo, who sent out an expedition for the purpose of collecting slaves. The two expeditions merged together, and sometime in June, the two ships made landfall at the mouth of a river on the Carolina coast, possibly the P.D. River in South Carolina, which they named the Jordan River. They landed, and Gordillo claimed the land discovered for Lucas Vazquez de Ailon and the Crown of Spain. So up until now, Gordillo had acted precisely as Ailon had instructed him to, but while ashore, the other captain persuaded Gordillo that there could be little harm in loading up a few of the natives to be taken away as slaves. So together, the two expeditions kidnapped more than 70 slaves from this land, which they called Chicora. When Gordillo returned, Ailon was furious that he had kidnapped slaves from the mainland. Now, this doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the humanity of Ailon, who, you should remember, was essentially the Eichmann of the encomienda system. But rather, this tells us of his desire to keep the natives friendly so that he would be able to colonize the area later without too much opposition. Ilon freed the slaves and made it clear that they were to be repatriated to their native land as soon as was practically feasible. But slaves or no slaves, Ilon now had his claim, and so in 1522 he headed back to Spain to request a royal grant to explore and colonize along the North American coast. And again, just as a tangent, it was on this voyage back to Spain, again in 1522, when he testified in front of the council which the king set up to investigate the matter of Cortes and Velazquez, of course offering a damning testimony against Velazquez and his man Narvaez. In any event, Narvaez finally received what he wanted on June 12, 1524, in the form of a royal license which granted him exclusive rights to settle whatever lands he would discover for a limited length of time, in exchange for his exploration of some 800 leagues of coastline. He was instructed to bring along with him a number of priests to convert the natives to Christianity, and as this conversion was a fairly high priority for Charles V, Ilon was expressly forbidden to enslave the Indians, including by way of the encomienda system. In 1526, Ilon finally set sail for Chicora with 600 men and a few women, including a few African slaves, with whom he planned to build his colony. Things went wrong for Ilon from the very beginning. Immediately following his arrival at the River Jordan, where Gordillo had kidnapped the Indians 5 years earlier, one of his ships ran aground in the river and had to be abandoned. Then, finding the land they were presently on entirely unsuitable for any sort of permanent habitation, the Spaniards relocated to another site around 120 miles away, possibly Cape Fear in North Carolina. There, Ilon and his men established the first European colony in the United States, which they named San Miguel de Guadalupe. San Miguel, however, was born under an evil star, and the entire endeavor was a disaster from the start. To begin with, as we mentioned, the Spanish lost most of their supplies along with their flagship in the Jordan River, which meant that the Spanish were short on food. The only way in which the Spanish would be able to get food would be through the largesse of the local Indians. The only problem was that there was insufficient food in the region to feed the Spanish party, and the Indians were less than enthusiastic to give up their spare supplies to these strangers who had just shown up on their doorstep. To compound this problem of a lack of supplies, a severe cold front set in early October, with the weather making a dramatic plunge from the mid-70s to near freezing in a matter of days. In addition, the settlement was built on low and swampy ground, and this combination of lack of food, the cold, and the swamps around them caused the Spanish settlers to begin to be struck down by disease, exposure, and malnutrition. The settlers began to drop like flies, and within a few weeks, on October 28, 1526, Ilon himself died of a fever. Ilon's death was a catastrophe for the nascent colony. Before he died, Ilon designated his nephew, Juan Ramirez, as his successor for control of the colony. However, as Ramirez was still in Puerto Rico, one of the colonists had to serve as a temporary replacement. The man chosen was a confidant of Ilon's by the name of Francis Gomez. Even so, however, there remained an acute vacuum of power in San Miguel. This absence of central authority, combined with the daily growing distress of the colonists, caused a complete breakdown in law and order. One group of colonists forced their way into an Indian village where they forced the natives to give them food until eventually the natives had enough and slew the band of colonists to the very last man. In the settlement itself, the dissensions aroused by Ilon's death soon flared into open mutiny. Two men, Pedro de Bassan and Gines Doncel, rose up in rebellion against the authorities, successfully launching a coup and throwing the mayor, Francis Gomez, along with the municipal council into jail. When two of the colonists protested, Bassan and Doncel conspired to murder them, lying in wait outside their house. Their plan was foiled, however, by a lucky coincidence. The African slaves of San Miguel, who were also suffering from the weather and disease, had chosen that night to launch the first ever slave rebellion in the Americas, torching Bassan and Dunsell's houses before scattering into the night. In the ensuing tumult, Bassan and Dunsell's ambush was discovered and the two men were imprisoned themselves, while Francis Gomez and the municipal council were released. After Bassan was hanged for mutiny, the dispirited settlers decided to abandon the colony and return to Hispaniola. Their return home was a miserable one, and they suffered tremendously from the bitter midwinter cold. 7 men froze to death on board one of the ships, and one poor sailor's legs froze so badly that he pulled his flesh off entirely from the knee down, with the consequence that he died later that night. In addition, yet another of their ships sank, taking down with it a number of colonists and the body of Ailon, whom they wished to return to Hispaniola for burial. When the survivors finally staggered back into Santo Domingo, only 150 survivors were left of the original 600. It was now 1527 and all of the American coast north of New Spain was up for grabs. With Garay died his claims on Amichel, with Ailon his claims on Chicora. The lands of America were now open to the man who would be able to come and take them. Next episode, we will discuss the fate of the next man who will attempt to achieve this feat. Our old friend, Pánfilo de Narváez.